Hi, I'm Jan Beatty. Tonight's episode of Prosody contains some adult content. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Priscilla Rodd. Priscilla Rodd was born outside Pawpaw, West Virginia, in an old farmhouse with no running water or electricity. Her birth was overseen by a midwife who was paid $50 and three old chickens for her service. Her parents, Quaker activists, homeschooled Priscilla until she was 11 years old. From there, Priscilla studied theater at Point Park College and Sarah Lawrence College, living for periods of time in Pittsburgh, Boston, and New York City. She eventually discovered creative writing and earned a Regents degree from West Virginia University. In 2002, her studies were completed with an MFA in fiction from the University of Pittsburgh. She'll be reading from her novel tonight, Surviving Mae West. Welcome to Prosody, Priscilla.
Thank you.
How about we start tonight with you reading?
Okay. This is the first entry of her journal, which is the beginning of the book. October 12th, 1995. I wash off the makeup and glitter and study myself in the dressing room mirror. Through a film of hairspray, my breasts look like limp water balloons pinned up at a county fair. Sweaty strands of black hair cling to my shoulders. My ribcage strains like a breastplate beneath my skin, suspended from jutting collarbones. I'm sitting at my kitchen table now, feeling too thin. That night, 2 weeks ago, I decided that if I didn't stop stripping, the stress of public exhibition would snap my bones and spill my guts all over the slick stage. Imagine the catcalls. So tonight was my first shift at the brothel. On my way uptown in the cab, I quietly chanted the house number. The identical brownstones didn't confuse me like they did when I interviewed. I should sleep, but I'm too wired. The morning vendors are unpacking paper lanterns and bags full of slippers in the street below. I'm running my toes over Pandy's sleek fur, trying to relax. I only saw one client, Whistling John. The guys choose their own code names, and he works as a jingle musician. Balding with a beer belly, he's the generic middle-aged man. But the whistler grew soulful during his oral solo. I actually came. Room 3 enhanced our encounter. A canopy bed, layered with a floral bedspread and pink sheets, crowds the room. A white love seat presses into one corner, and sitting on the side table is a plastic bouquet that looks like wildflowers in the dim light. I got nervous when John asked me to clarify a price, not part of the routine. See, 5 to 10 of us are corralled into the living room, and once we're picked out of the herd, we lead a guy to his room. Before briefly exiting, we tell him to get completely comfortable, which means he must take off all his clothes, including his socks. Stripping entirely naked is supposedly against police protocol, so Diane requires sock removal as a final precaution. Then we pop back in and ask how long he's staying. Prompted on the phone about prices and routines, the guys hand us the money for an hour or a half hour. Either way, discussing money in the brothel is taboo. Wide-eyed, I remembered the backup plan. I told John to call Diane on the intercom, one in each room, if he was confused about anything. No, he said. I'm pretty sure I'm right. Keep the change, in fact. Then he rolled onto the bed. His butt was as pink as an orangutan's. It shocked me for that second, his nudity. I don't know why he bucked protocol. He knows I'm new. Maybe he tested me for Diane. If so, I guess I passed. We're taught to take the money without comment and excuse ourselves to hide the cash in a purse or our shoes or any safe place. The last step is to call down on the intercom to say we're in room 3 or 4 for half an hour or an hour or whatever. I assumed he enjoyed himself, but truthfully, his whole body and face blended into a mass of flesh I simply concentrated on stimulating. Rub this thigh, those biceps, like a hot potato. You don't get a good look. Personal life-wise, attacks still sneak up. Even as I'm writing, relaxing, I'm shaking like I caught a chill. Nothing and nobody feels familiar. My face burns. Time to take a shower. October 14th. Susan returned from visiting her folks today and found me asleep, buck naked on our black and white kitchen floor, one hand wrapped around a bag of M&Ms. Very rock star. Knowing a bit about my attacks, she nudged me awake with her foot and handed me my robe and a cold beer. We both started to chuckle after a couple of chugs, even though my breasts were sore from being smushed against the hard floor. Sliding my Tammy Wynette CD into our stereo, Susan sang along as she made herself a ham sandwich, drowning out the loud voices moving up and down the block this afternoon. I resisted the urge to hug her. Laid back act aside, she's overwhelmed by her new roommate. She misses her Chinese boyfriend who landed her this pad. With a mouthful of ham, she asked if I got nervous being such a delicate girl. I'm wiry, I said, and swigged. Aren't you scared of AIDS, even with condoms? It's safer than one-night stands. And if you're going to be 20 and messed up, you might as well go the whole nine yards. I winked and headed to my bedroom to dress and escape the third degree.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Priscilla Rodd, reading from her first novel, Surviving Mae West. Okay, Priscilla, the first thing I have to ask is, did the midwife think the $50 and the three old chickens was good payment?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, no, I think I would have wanted three new chickens.
Evidently, their meat is better, is what she believed. She specifically asked for old ones. She said she was a great-grandmother who brought five of her great-grandchildren with her to oversee my birth. So.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So I wanted to start first just with the title of the book, Surviving Mae West. It's, you know, Mae West is an icon that's brought up in the book
right. In
terms of female sexuality. But I wonder how you came to that title and just kind of the role that that title plays in terms of the shaping of the book.
Well, the story of Mae West in terms of her biography is that she was this 30s really, movie star. And she always played the happy hooker. Her big line was, come up and see me sometime, which she is known for saying to Cary Grant in particular. And she basically got to the point where she played this role so often, even though she was this total wild woman. She, you know, groundbreaking. She wrote, she was on Broadway with a play called Sex. But in the end, they say she sort of became that character, that the woman she was before she pretended to be Mae West all the time was gone. And that there's something, I think, that women can fall into a trap of being limited in their lives. And I think Tess is kind of falling into the trap of being limited, particularly by fear, because a lot of what she's doing is being motivated by a rape she experienced and that fear that's come out of that. And so I guess what I'm sort of talking about is, one, the women's desire to explore our sexuality, but then how it can be, it can come around and take control. That,
sure.
You know what I mean? That can sort of take control. So she does not live such a full life at the time when the novel begins.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think in terms of people remembering Mae West, if they've seen any of her movies, it is that kind of stereotype that she became. But it's a stereotype of this very kind of free, oversexed woman. But ultimately, it is. It's really limiting. It only allows you to see that aspect of her. You never think of her as being smart or particularly strong or, you know, I don't think you would imagine her sitting down playing concert piano or something like that. She's just that person. And I was thinking about that in terms of Tess. I mean, she's young and she's had a traumatic thing happen in her life.
Right.
And she's trying to find, she's kind of acting her way out of it, you know, acting out the trauma. And that it's interesting that what she chooses to do is become a hooker in a brothel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people, I think it's very common for women who experience sexual trauma to put themselves in sexual situations that push those boundaries again because they're trying to overcome those things, those feelings, that sense of helplessness. She happens to go the route of doing it in a brothel situation. Many people just do it by sleeping around a lot. Mm-hmm. So I think her story is unique in that it's a brothel, but it's also very common.
Right.
As a way that women often deal with sexual trauma and the after effects.
Yeah, and it shows that, you know, she's got a savvy to her, even in that section where it's like, well, it's better than a one-night stand. At least she's making some money out of her quirks, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So how about you read a little bit more from the book?
Okay. October 24th. I'm a wreck. I vow not to smack another customer. And I want a companion. When I'm lonely, the wind seems to blow right through me. Sam and I, that's her brother, used to play King of the Mountain in Ray's Boulder Field. We climbed to the top of these 10-foot-high rocks, finding finger holes in the angled walls. "They're fossilized dinosaur turds," Sam claimed. "Honest," he'd say, "honest. Don't you notice the faint odor?" I thought he was so funny. On top of the boulder, we'd assume sumo wrestling positions, trying to push each other off, carefully, of course, so the other person could twist and land on their feet. We never got hurt, just worked up an appetite. Lunch was part of the ritual, which meant a PB&J, a Twix candy bar, and 3 Cokes for me, 3 beers, and Kentucky Fried Chicken for Sam. We discussed our wrestling techniques and how so much depended on solid footing, analyzed Harrison Ford's appeal in Star Wars versus Indiana Jones. During moments of silence, the sound of the nearby stream sliding over rocks and tumbling against the dirt banks reached our ears. Ray's cows filed past below us, their tails twitching. The hovering flies lunged at our food, sending us into a new battle, reviving us. 2 months ago, I tried working at the dry cleaners. Most country people are smart enough to buy clothes that go in regular washers, but in New York, I cater to the rich. "Hello there. Starch? Tag clothes, ring up the register, sit down, and wait, 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 again and again and again." The day I quit, I headed back to my apartment, so restless that I tore my stack of newspapers and magazines into shreds. The plan to create homemade confetti ended with my bedroom floor and mattress coated in bits of paper. A ticker tape parade, scissors shredding, books too, hands black with ink. Then I sprinted up Canal Street, a white chick running hard in a red flamenco skirt. The soles of her feet pink and hot, she paused to catch her breath. She, her, me. At least the house drowns out my crazier urges. I've traded emotional explosions for the urge to whisper, "I'm a prostitute," to upper crust women on the subway. I itch to tell people that we walk among them like vampires. I will one day. My wild side is genetic. In the blissful era before Sam's DUI, Ma tied sponges to her feet and sang opera along with West Virginia Public Radio while she stomped out paint. Dad laid canvases on the attic floor for her to pound, sponge, or splash. One smaller canvas was framed and stood on her easel, the last one to be painted, where Ma's reality would find its place. Blurred subject arose as her final vision. Couples and children stretched out like highway lights, photographed with a slow blinking lens. As a teenager, I expressed my creativity by masturbating on the wooden bedroom floor because my bed squeaked. No one would have heard, but the possibility terrified me into elaborate disguises, like pillows over my face and under my butt as I snuck fingers below my waistband. Afterwards, I'd blast Me and Bobby McGee, line my lips and eyes in black, and throw on my red bathrobe with peacock embroidered along the hemline. Winking at the mirror, I'd dance, or sometimes follow the scent of Merlot and wailing of arias to the attic where Dad had cut skylights in the walls and filled them with glass and treetops for his wife, the rough woman he followed. I'd sit cross-legged across from Ma, sharing the wine, laughing about primitive painting urges. She'd sit on a fringed pillow, legs spread, her feet propped on pieces of newspaper. Grayish liquid slid down the sides of her ankles. Pieces of twine held the damp sponges in place, squeezing her feet so tight that thick purple veins strained between the ropes. She'd finger paint her gray temples brown when no one was watching, claiming she was simply messy. Sometimes I'd visit her when I felt tired, wearing plain jeans and a t-shirt. We turn the music down low and whisper for the sake of my teenage heart. But always, after 20 minutes, her eyes would slip to the tray of colors on the floor, and the sponges would start bouncing up and down. Her sentences would begin with upward, encouraging tones, and I'd know paint and opera tugged at her. I'd leave her with a dry mouth, a few words still stuffed inside. Missing her, I even miss the half-empty feeling.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Priscilla Rod, reading from her first novel, Surviving Mae West, out of West Virginia University Press. You know, I'm glad you read that section because I think with the content of the book, it could easily be seen as this is a book about sex and men and women. But I think a lot of the book is actually about relationships between women. Tess and her roommates, Tess and her mother, Tess and her friend from back when she dropped out of college. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, like balancing those two. Maybe it's balancing the sex with the women's relationships. I don't know. But it seems to me that there's even a change in the language. It becomes much more lyric, much more internal when she's speaking about women, and it's much more external when it comes to her job with men.
Well, I mean, I think Tess, a lot of her is yearning for a relationship with her mother, but her brother was always in such crisis because he was an alcoholic that she was never able to really get the support from her mother that she wanted. Plus, her mother's a fairly distracted parent whose needs often go before her children's needs. So she definitely is yearning for a relationship with her mother. She also has not told her mother about the rape. And so there is a lot of yearning to tell her mother about that. But there has definitely been a rift in their relationship since that, even further than it was before. So, yes, I think it is an important part. I think her ability to have an open and kind of close relationship with her roommate, Susan, in some ways allows her to maybe to reach out to her mother. And Susan's a little rough, too, like her mother is. So I do think they're important. I think her relationships, I feel like the books, at its heart, in my mind, it's about her relationships, her intimate relationships with her family and her friends, also with her brother. You know, I feel like that's where its heart is. And it's funny because in my mind, the focus is so much on that. I sort of forget about all the prostitution and stuff that's going on in terms of her, you know, just day-to-day work stuff. And sometimes I read it and I'm like, oh my goodness, there's a lot of that in there, isn't there? Because, you know, I do feel like that's the beating heart of the book. Sure. And I feel like her language, it was fun to play with that in terms of the journal style. But when she does go home, when she does interact with those, I agree. I think that I made a move towards more lyrical language at those times because that is the tender part of her, the more vulnerable part of Tess that she, in some ways, doesn't want to deal with because it is also the part of her that's hurt. And she's not trying to deal with her hurt. She's just trying to survive
right
at this point at the beginning. And so it's sort of she needs to allow herself to be in that space more. But to be in that vulnerable space also means that the sex work at times can be unbearable when she's vulnerable and yet still doing prostitution. So, yeah, I do feel like you've hit a very good point there that a lot of people, the sensational aspects of the book sort of stand out in terms of when you're first speaking about it. But it's definitely the relationships that I feel like are really key in terms of what is motivating her and pushing the character and where is the place that she grows
right
within the story.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, from Tessa's perspective, and probably that's, you know, whenever you're writing, you have to inhabit the space of the characters that you're with. I mean, sure, she's a prostitute, but in a certain sense, it's kind of like factory work.
Yeah.
Or working at fast food. I mean, it's next customer.
Right. She even says that at one point in the book. Next. Right.
So for her, you know, it's not the glamorized, the, you know, the fantasized Mae West version of it. It's actually the Mae West, the actress going, oh, I have to act sexy again. Okay.
Right. Putting on the heavy makeup, the corset.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That there's the actor side of it that's not, that can be very gritty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the journal style of the book. Mm-hmm. That's not, you know, usually it's not a usual style. There's been some work that's been done in it. So one, what attracted you to that as a writer and what you felt it did in helping to develop Tess as a character?
Well, it was very important to me that Tess be able to use writing as a way to kind of gain insight into herself. So in some ways, I see it as very much part of the plot that the writing actually allows her to see what she's doing and make changes in her life. It's not very overt, but in my mind, it's there. So I liked it for that reason. I wanted her to use telling her own story as a way to kind of move forward. On the other hand, I also liked it because I felt like it was a way that she could kind of control her story. You know, I mean, that was important for her to feel so out of control about what had happened to her. And then here she is. And this is a way of her to tell her story the way she wants to tell it in the format that she wants to tell it, in the time. Like what happens to her is slowly mm-hmm. revealed as she kind of slowly comes to terms with it. So I was interested in that. I also thought it was important to convey the day-to-day life of a prostitute, which is fairly humdrum. You know what I mean? They can be, you know, I mean, you're sitting there and she's watching Die Hard because, you know, she's worked for 7 hours and maybe she'll see three guys. You know what I mean? So it's not like she's on the bed having great sex constantly. You know, I mean, she's just hanging out. And, you know, her apartment and so on. So I guess, and
kinda
I
like
also
working at the car wash.
Right, exactly. Just hanging out till another car comes through. So, and then I felt like she, you know, she had a lot of things to say. So I liked her voice. I enjoyed writing her, voice as a writer. It was interesting to me to change her language as she broached different topics. There was a lot of different aspects to it that I enjoyed. I also felt like because she had been so silenced about what had happened to her and the rape, that it was really important that she have an outlet for that because she wasn't somebody who was going to share it with other people. And so it would be a very internal examination of what had happened and what she was doing. So I thought that reflected her character and how she would go about coping with something that she didn't really want to ask other people for help for. You know, she was very defiant of the fear. And so she wanted to really deal with it herself.
Great. How about you read a little bit more?
January 4th, there at the brothel. Nobody fun to talk to tonight, avoiding Diane and the smack on the head that's inevitable if I piss her off again. Diane is a madam. I watched a talk show about former female geeks who had succeeded in their careers, lost weight, got boob jobs, straightened their hair, and so on, and hoped to rub the transformation in the faces of boys, now men, who harassed them as kids. Of course, the men refused to apologize. Not one man took responsibility for his behavior. Their common line, "We were kids." A guy with a sensitive ponytail argued that his childhood victim still looked like a dog. And truth be told, the girl hadn't grown into a lovely swan. She smiled grimly, absorbing his new insults, an ugly duckling wearing orange foundation and frosted pink lipstick, back for more abuse. The worst part of it was that the women wanted the affirmation of these men. I just want the bastard dead. These women appeared on national TV to face the real possibility that the same bullies might say more horrible things. Like Rob may claim that I enjoyed sex with him. Maybe he tells his frat boyfriends that I asked for it rough. If Rob and I were on that show and some guy cheered him, I'd pull out a gun. I'd press the tip into his gut and blow his stomach apart.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Priscilla Rodd, reading from her first novel, Surviving Mae West. So I have to ask, this is a pretty challenging topic that you've come up with in a time or that you've come to at a time when there's so much censorship going on. You know, don't talk about bad things that happen. Don't talk about them publicly. You know, we even had to kind of go through a checklist before you read your book of what couldn't go on over the airwaves.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering, you know, have you felt any pressure at all in terms of reading the book or thank goodness you're talking about these kind of topics or, you know, anything in that kind of regard, kind of the popular culture that we seem to be getting more and more conservative. And this is a book that is kind of poking at conservatism in a certain sense.
Well, it's interesting. I've gotten both. I mean, I've at an interest because my own experience with trauma, I've definitely been interested in putting this book out there for women who have experienced trauma as well. So, for example, I've reached out to rape crisis centers and domestic violence shelters who do a lot of rape counseling. And they, of course, have been wonderful and really supportive. On the other hand, I've gotten a funny reaction within what would maybe be the expected field to embrace me in women's studies. Some women really like it, the more positive, sex positive feminists. But the more old school feminists, some of them have a problem with it because while she's doing this, she doesn't all, I mean, sometimes she will have an orgasm or it's not all negative. And so people will feel like, well, maybe this is endorsing prostitution. And I'm like, well, if you read the whole book, you really probably wouldn't think this is endorsing prostitution. I mean, I'm not like anti-prostitution, but I, you know what I mean? But I definitely think her story is a little bit more complex than just rah, rah, this is lots of fun.
Yeah, it doesn't glamorize it. And it does bring it across as a very work aspect of it that sitting around waiting for somebody else to come. It's not like, you know, a job that you're like, oh, that just sounds like exactly what I want to do.
Right. Yeah, I would hope not. Yeah. And then On the other hand, it's been funny because the sex positive community, I've been trying to sort of approach them and say, well, okay, if the old school feminists aren't enjoying it, maybe they would sort of understand it and appreciate what I'm trying to do in terms of a realism and a woman who is making a choice here and owning her own sexuality. But on the but they have sometimes had more issue with it because some of them who are more pro sex industry, which, you know, again, I very much think should be legalized. I don't, you know what I mean, have problems with. On the other hand, they don't like that it does have a lot of darkness to it. Her story does, particularly because it's coming from a place of trauma. So it's kind of funny. It sits in the middle, which I guess is good because it pushes everybody's buttons, you know. But on the other hand, you know, I'm always like, all right, somebody's supposed to cheer me on, you know. But a lot of people, it encourages debate, which I think is, you know, sure. I'm proud of that it does that.
Did it present any challenges as you were trying to get the book published?
Yes, definitely. You know, just because, you know, people hesitate, shy away from the subject, which is why I was really grateful WVU Press picked it up. And I thought they might because they had picked another book, Crumb by Lee Maynard, which had been banned. And so I was like, and it got him a lot of publicity. So I was like, I can be banned. Take me. We'll get a lot of publicity. I'll be banned somewhere. It'll be great. So actually, Pat Connor, the director, said, he said, in the time of John Ashcroft, the University Press's job is to publish these kind of books. So I definitely appreciate
that's excellent. Sentiment. That's excellent. Because, yeah, I mean, there is the idea that it should be able to rely on people's intellect and their taste to pick what they like and then not have the choices narrowed before they even get the option to do that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, everybody says, I was talking recently to somebody and I was showing them the beginning of my next book and they were saying, well, it has a lot of sex in it. I'm like, well, I like to write about sex, I guess. So hopefully somebody else will publish that one too.
Well, my guess is that we should just stop right there. What more needs to be said after that? Thanks for coming to Prosody, Priscilla.
Sure. You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She has